if you're going to be a founder, please, please think about the problem you're solving and what you're going to dedicate your life to and make it something meaningful.
Welcome back to 40 Minute Mentor, the podcast on a mission to make mentorship more accessible by interviewing brilliant leaders who are building exceptional purpose-driven brands. Today, I'm joined by the brilliant Sho Sugihara, the founder and CEO of Pave, a UK-based fintech for good, helping customers improve their credit score and history with bill monitoring and credit building. Having started his career working with NGOs around the world, Sho is driven by the desire to build a world free of financial inequality and give financial power back to the individuals. That's why he started Pave out of Entrepreneur First in 2017. I've admired Sho's journey for years as we share a few mutual friends, and I'm so excited for you all to hear his story and the brilliant work that Pave are doing around financial equality. So Sho, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you on the podcast. How are things?
Good, thanks. And thanks for having me on the podcast as well.
Good stuff. Well, we would like to get to know you a little bit better. So we'll start with our normal quickfire questions. So could you finish the following sentences after me? First up, one of my daily habits is?
Coffee. I'm a bit boring. I'm not one of those CEOs that meditates every day or has a strict schedule, unfortunately.
Do you know what? I'm the same. As long as I've had a coffee each morning, I'm typically good to go. My first ever job was?
This one's a little better. Delivering magazines to homeless vendors in Osaka. But I actually had another job I started at the same time, which was as a busser. So like people who clean up the dishes in a hotel that was frequented by the local Japanese mafia. That was pretty fun.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you saw a few interesting things. That's definitely a first. Love that. Great answer. Brilliance to me means?
I think, at least in people that I look up to, people who are very true to themselves are the people that I think are brilliant.
I love that. Thank you. I wish I could be better at?
Having daily habits? No. actually, to be honest, I think consistency around non-work stuff is something I really wish I was better at.
That's a very honest view and very frequent answer from founders, I'd say. I guess startup life can be all-consuming, can't it? And things like hobbies and friendships and social stuff can sometimes go out the window. But I think all of that stuff is good for the soul too, and it's good to get that balance. So it's something I'm working on as well. A misconception people have about me is?
Yeah, this one I think about a lot. It's actually one of our interview questions. So I would say, I think people can sometimes think I'm a bit aloof when they meet me for the first time. And the reason is, it's not because I'm not interested. It's much more because I'm actually very shy and introverted. So that's I think a misconception.
That's really interesting. And I think I'm starting to meet a lot more founders that are being open about their introversion. That's a superpower in many ways, I think. You can see how sometimes people can get the wrong opinion when you are naturally more shy. So I really appreciate that. Has that been challenging at times being a CEO? Because obviously you're front man of your business, you know, out in the industry talking to investors and selling the dream.
Yeah, I mean, it can be. I think it's actually a really kind of, there's lots there. I'll keep it brief. But sometimes in pitch feedback, I'll get feedback like, oh, you don't seem excited about your business or whatnot. And I'm like, what on earth are you talking about? Do you think I would do this for X many years if I wasn't? And I think there's a lot to do with like style, which is partly due to perhaps universal traits that you could condense as introversion versus extroversion. But I think there's also a cultural element. Like in the cultures that I grew up in, being outspoken about your own accomplishments or, you know, coming across braggy is just considered really off-putting. And so, I mean, I only spent half of my life in Japan, but still it's a significant portion. And I think those traits do carry across to your day-to-day. So I've certainly encountered some interesting cultural nuances that were eye-opening to me.
That is really interesting. And I think, you know, I don't know about others listening to this, but my natural inclination is always to favor the humble founder over the arrogant one. But it's interesting how, you know, when investors are looking what business to back, I can imagine that at times that confidence can go in the favor of extroverts, which isn't always the right thing, because that means they're probably very good at selling and there might always be the substance there.
Yeah.
Finally, Sho, can you share something that we wouldn't learn from your CV? So that could be a failure, a setback in your career that you've learned a lot from.
I would take a little bit of a different spin. I think for me, I went to a very special high school that I was really lucky to attend called United Rural Colleges. where I went to school with 200 people from 100 different countries, and it was full board. So kind of lived together, saw too much of each other. And they had a very strong social mission and purpose, where they expect graduates to work on causes that have social impact, whether startup or government or whatever. And that's, it is very, very core to who I am. And I think, yeah, scanning my CV, you probably wouldn't spot that, but it's a big part of my identity.
And I didn't know that. And that is amazing because, well, our board advisor, Cress, you're a great friend of mine. I think episode 3 of 40 Minute Mentor is also from the same school. And she came on the podcast.
Really?
Interestingly, just like yourself, she is, you know, so focused on changing the world and doing things, you know, social impact. I mean, she's actually an environmental entrepreneur. And she talked on the episode when she first came on the podcast about the impact that school had had on her. And one of our colleagues at JBM, Perry, is also from that school. So when we were interviewing Perry and Cressy found out about it, she was like, hire her. You know, it sounds like an incredibly special place. So that is such a small world.
I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, these things, I was at dinner with someone the other day who turned out to be UWC, and you're like instant friends. I mean, it's to some extent like nepotistic, but still, it's good for a good cause.
And Cho, we will definitely make sure we all get together with those people because it sounds like you'd have a lot to talk about. Amazing. Well, already you've got a really interesting insight into your personality and some snippets of earlier parts of your life. And it sounds like you grew up in Japan, as you said. And I know you started working at the Big Issue and then worked at an NGO in Brazil, which is an alternative, I guess, start to a career than maybe others that we've spoken to on this podcast. Can you tell our listeners then just a bit more about your upbringing and particularly that passion that you have for social purpose? I think it sounds like schooling had a big part of it, but tell us a bit more about the earlier life for you.
Yeah, so I grew up in Kyoto, or the city next to it called Shiga, which is a little smaller, but, you know, 15 minutes away. My mom is English, my dad is Japanese, and so grew up in a bit of a multicultural family because Japan is quite culturally homogeneous. And I was there until I was 16 before I went to the UWC school in Canada. I think from how did I get interested in social causes and entrepreneurship? I think one of my earliest memories is learning about homelessness, and that happened in Kyoto, where there is actually a surprisingly big population of homeless people. And that was a memory that really stuck with me at a very young age. I think I was in preschool when I learned about this, the fact that, you know, some people just don't have homes. And I took that to heart. And when I was at UWC in Canada, I had a summer where they expected everyone to go back to their local communities and contribute. So yeah, you can see it's really like quite hardcore social focused school. And I emailed the Big Issue because I was interested in what they were doing. They responded, which was amazing of them because I was what, a 17-year-old with no work experience. And they were like, come and work for a summer. So I went and worked for them. Yeah, delivering magazines to the vendors across Osaka City on bicycle, which was amazing because I learned some really powerful life stories of people. And I think you learn how precarious a lot of the things that we take for granted are. These aren't, you know, most of the vendors are people who are extremely motivated and just had a really rough patch. And you learn how actually even small things like being able to give them a sense of confidence by letting them sell, even if they don't sell much magazines, or, you know, these things can contribute and make a huge difference to someone's lives. And so that was an eye-opening experience for me. I then, after I finished school in Canada, I was 18. I didn't speak a word of Portuguese. Someone taught me, said they knew Portuguese, and I was kind of hanging out with them, and turns out they taught me Spanish, so, which is not, you know, it's useful, but not very useful. And so I go to Brazil and spent a year living with 6 or 7 other volunteers in this tiny, tiny house, more like a shack. And I did everything from helping deliver microfinance or conditional cash transfers, which were a big thing back then in Brazil, and they pioneered that model. I did organic farming to feed kids in the area and, you know, give them healthy food. And I also did kind of social care work and also after school care programs for children to keep them off the streets. And taught guitar and Japanese. It was a really wild mix of stuff. But I think that experience, I was working for the founder indirectly, but still got a chance to hang out with her a bit. And she was a German lady who'd gone over to Brazil in like the 70s or 80s when it was much, much more dangerous and a difficult place to live. And she also had no Portuguese, but ended up founding this NGO that is serving the thousands, tens of thousands, I think, of people every year and really making a difference in their lives. And that was my foray into more entrepreneurial causes. I actually thought I was going to be in the social sector, but I did get a bit disillusioned by how reliant you are on external funding and politics. And I thought private sector innovation has its place if channeled right. And I still believe in that very strongly. And I think actually there's going to be a lot more exciting stuff to come on that front. But that's how I got into entrepreneurship. But since I had zero experience in the private sector, that's why I went into consulting and did all these things.
Amazing. Yeah, no, but I think it says a lot about you, just the route you've taken and how much you care. I mean, it explains a lot about your subsequent career. And you mentioned you went into consulting next, which is a well-trodden path, let's be honest, for entrepreneurial people and founders. And it sounded like you did that as a way to save up for your first business. So clearly there was a lot of thought behind that. Have you always had that entrepreneurial spirit, do you think? Yeah, it'd be good to understand sort of what you got from that consulting experience and also when you decided was the right time to kind of jump out and start Pay.
Yeah, great question. I would actually say, again, I don't want to kind of BS people here. I don't think I wasn't that kid selling lemonade on the street, age 5, right? That wasn't me. But I was always the kid who did, like with the homelessness thing, I did have a sense of, I guess, like social justice that I wanted to contribute towards. And that's been my driver. It's much more macro than a sort of problem solving, market arbitrage or profit generating thing. Neither do I have a entrepreneurial upbringing per se, although my parents are very creative and bold people. But, you know, my mom's an artist and my dad's a hardware engineer. So it wasn't quite like a entrepreneurial pedigree. Now, that said, I think the strong sense of like social purpose and then that being accentuated by my high school experience drove me to want to work on causes that were much bigger and difficult to solve. And so that's where my drive has come from. In terms of, you know, the decision when to become an entrepreneur, I think it was in Brazil where I was like, this is awesome. Starting something yourself, figuring it out and actually seeing the impact from that. And then I went to McKinsey because, I don't know, there's like 2 or 3 reasons. I think, yeah, one was financial. I didn't feel financially secure. I didn't really have anything to fall back on and wanted to clear debt. 2 was because I thought it would be a really quick way to learn about problems, private sector practices. And then 3 is because I think if I didn't, my dad would have been really pissed. If I got straight into entrepreneurship, I think it might have been too much risk there. You know, I guess that's a half reason, but still it was in the back of my mind, to be very transparent.
And it gives you a prestige. And as you say, you get to work with incredible people and, you know, a whole range of brands. I mean, it's a yeah, there's a reason why ex-McKinseyites have, you know, there's so many CEOs there that are off the back of it. So it's totally legitimate. I guess one thing that I'd be interested to know is the difference from as somebody that's done consulting and then went very quickly into becoming a founder. I mean, probably a lot earlier than many people would start their entrepreneurial journey. What for you is the major difference between that founder mindset, and I guess perhaps anyone listening to this that might be thinking, oh, you know, I'm in consulting now, but actually, do I want to go down that route? What's the difference between that founder mindset versus the consulting mindset? I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I guess there's kind of mindset and skill set. I mean, on the mindset side, I think the large firm consulting, well, you can be a self-starter and that can often lead to like promotion and good things, but it's rare. It's not always encouraged. Typically, you're handed things to do. One of the biggest things that I had to switch as a founder was like, there will be days where you have no traction, nothing, and you're just sitting there like, you know, tumble dust rolling in the background, a tumbleweed or whatever you call it. And you're thinking like, what do I do? And you have to think about like, okay, I'm going to set this objective for myself and execute. And that's a very different mindset. It's creating something from nothing. In terms of skill set, this one I think about a lot. I do think there's a strong overlap between consultancy and startup in how they develop your problem solving skills. That's incredible. Like rationally breaking down a problem and then figuring out an execution plan. People say consultants can't execute. I think they're completely wrong. I think actually some of the best executors come from these types of firms. And maybe, the last thing is communication. You get trained, at least at McKinsey, they train you a huge amount on comms and storytelling. And that can be very useful for team or investor vision communication. And I've certainly reaped benefits from that. I think where, to be critical, where there isn't much overlap, detailed customer focus, that is not a thing. That sounds like we don't care about our clients at a consulting firm. That's not entirely true. But what I mean is like one step before that. Like if you're trying to discover a problem to solve for a fast growing market, you don't get really trained on that skill set. And that's a very, very different skill set. It's much more in some ways like ethnographic and psychological. And I think you have to learn different things. I would say that's the biggest skill that took me time to adjust and learn.
That's really interesting and really, really helpful, I think, for anyone that might be working out whether that is a route for them. We've been sort of teasing our audience with information about what Pave is, and you know, we've got a really good glimpse into their backstory to it. But can you tell anyone that hasn't heard of the business before, give us your elevator pitch. What does the business do? Like, tell us a bit about how it all came into existence.
Yeah, sure. I'll start with the how it came into existence. So I joined after leaving McKinsey, Entrepreneur First, which is also ex-McKinsey founders. And then in 2017, I met Chris, my co-founder, and we kind of instantly got along and started iterating, because Entrepreneur First is as context, you join without an idea. But of course, like I had this background of wanting to do something in financial inclusion. I actually looked at healthcare as well, because that's another complex system that I would love to work on in the future as well. But eventually we settled on finance, because at the time, 2017, 2018, Uber, Deliveroo, these startups were growing very quickly and becoming adopted by a much wider range of individuals. And we were thinking, if you think about how the people working for those platforms earn, first of all, they're self-employed, so they don't have any benefits. And that means they have less financial security. Sounds like there's a problem space there that we could go after. And so I rode for Deliveroo a bit to understand what the job is like. And it's actually really lonely, which was an interesting insight. Yeah, you're just riding around all day delivering stuff unless there's a community of people you bond with. And then the second thing was I needed the kit, because no one would trust me as a delivery rider if I just went up to them and started chatting like, what do you do for, a living and for your money? And so, we wore the outfit and hung around places where riders would congregate and started interviewing them. Now, that's a long-winded way to say how we started getting insight, but we did a lot of interviews. And again, I won't gloss over this. Like it took us, 15, 20 iterations of the product. We went from tax returns to benefits delivery to various other things before we started hearing a repeat problem, which was lack of access to affordable credit. Many of the riders were migrants, which meant they had no credit file, or they were recovering from mismanaging credit, and that can take a really long time and a lot of effort. The system to do it is very opaque and difficult in the market today. And so we started thinking, okay, let's launch a credit score building product that is better than anything out there. The product is different that we have because, first of all, unlike a credit card, which is typically what you're told to take out to build credit, our product offers a subscription fee method, and there's no interest, no other fees. And that's important because it gives predictability to someone who might have volatile income. And the second thing we do is usually a credit card is designed to make money the more you spend money. But we thought, how can we turn that model on its head? And so obviously we only have a fixed fee, so we don't make many more money by you spending. But what we do is instead, every time we see a bill payment coming out of your bank account, which we can monitor through this technology called open banking, we will, let you know if that's something you can afford, or if we think there's a upcoming bill in the future that might put you in the negative, we warn you in advance. And then the most advanced thing that we've developed is a small credit line. And we open this credit line to top up your account if your balance goes below a certain amount. So it's like a smart overdraft system, and that prevents you from damaging your credit score. And a lot of this data, with your consent, of course, gets reported to the credit bureaus who manage your financial history and health, and it can positively improve your financial footprint over time.
That's incredible. So it sounds like the business has evolved a lot over time. You mentioned the various different iterations. Can you tell us a bit more about that? I guess those first few years, and I guess to now, what have been the major evolutions of the company. I know you rebranded not too long ago, so it'd be good just to hear a bit more about kind of how it's got to where you are today and I guess where you're at as a business now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think one of the major changes we made was in distribution strategy early on. We were thinking that it would be cost effective to partner with someone like Deliveroo, which we did, and kind of distribute our app product to their riders through them. And that worked quite well in terms of uptake and NPS and all this stuff. But we found out that that distribution method quickly hit a ceiling because there's only so many gig economy firms you can go after unless you expand globally, which with a fintech product in credit is particularly difficult. And so we adjusted the product to be direct to consumer, mass market, and didn't initially had focused on the self-employed, but expanded our audience to be anyone because the problem was much bigger than we thought as well. So that was maybe 2019. 2020 with COVID, there was some other stuff. We hadn't focused as much on selling the credit score building vision, but we did a lot of interviews when lockdown first happened and understood from our customers that for the first time, many of them were able to save money, pay off debt, and be in a financially quite healthy position because they were saving money by working from home or there was furlough and these things. And that meant they were thinking longer term. They were thinking about how do I build my credit health up to a point where I can actually get a mortgage? And that created huge demand for credit score building. And so we adjusted our product a little bit, although the elements were very similar, to cater to that need. And that really helped the product take off very, very quickly. It was pretty exceptional growth that it was really exciting. 2022, again, we're facing an interesting market where there's a lot of income volatility. I think we've gone from the let's fix our financial health stage to I just have to survive. You know, I need to make this energy payment and, you know, I'm going to have to max out on my credit card because I just don't have a choice type situation, which is really sad. But it is what it is. And in that environment, we've been focusing a lot more on helping people manage their bill payments and stay on top of those. And we reckon that, again, like it's cyclical, right? After this phase, there's going to be another phase where people are like, oh, shoot, I need to fix my credit again. And then, so yeah, we're trying to create a product that can be versatile in different market climates. But those are the major changes we've gone through. There's one more, but I mean, we can touch on that later.
Okay, awesome. And in terms of the size of the business and, you know, funding status, can you share a bit more for anyone that's interested, perhaps in coming on the journey or maybe any investors listening?
No, sure. So we've raised about 10 mil in total. We're like 25, 30 people in terms of kind of downloads of the product. We're near 500,000 and multi-million ARR or annual recurring revenue run rate on the consumer app product. What else? Yeah, I mean, those are the key stats. So I think relative to our revenue, we're very proud of having not raised actually a ton of money because that gives us maneuverability, but also has focused us on financial health. And I can't say the exact details, but the burn rate of the business is extremely healthy compared to many others out there, I would say right now, which we're, you know, I don't mean that in a snarky way. I mean that I'm grateful that we've been lean from the get-go.
Yeah. And it doesn't surprise me given what you're doing to help others around like the financial health and doing right by them and supporting them on that journey that you're running the business in a very sensible way, which I think is sadly not always the case. And we're obviously living in a time where there are a lot of companies that have gone to the wall in recent times because of kind of growth at all cost mentality. And I have huge respect for that. I'm a bootstrap founder who has lived the ups and downs of that existence, but I'm grateful to have kind of chosen that path and stayed profitable. But yeah, different horses for courses, but I have a lot of admiration for you, the way you've done it and for the products you're building and shipping and the impact that can have, because we've always talked on this podcast a lot about social mobility. And frankly, there is this growing gap between the wealthy and those in different parts of society that are struggling, and they need help with this sort of stuff. And I think it's great that there's technology and companies like Pave that are actually really leading the way on that. So thanks for all you're doing and big kudos.
I really hope you're enjoying today's episode so far. But before we continue hearing from today's mentor, I wanted to take a minute to give a shout out to our series sponsors, Alchemist. Alchemist is an industry-leading learning and development company using immersive and interactive experiences to help increase employee engagement, levels of happiness, and achievement across your teams and overall productivity. Alchemist presents L&D departments with an opportunity to innovate and be bold in their approaches to blended learning. If you love the sound of this as much as we do here at JBM, then head over to thisisalchemist.com/40-minute mentor to learn more. And now back to our 40-minute mentor.
It'd be good just to talk a bit about the recent B2B service that you launched, all designed around helping businesses make the best of their lending decisions. It'd be great to just understand like what made you branch into the B2B space. We obviously talked about the D2C arm. And I'd love to know the challenges of, you know, going down the B2B route versus the B2C proposition, because they're very different beasts.
Yeah, look, I mean, to address that one head on, like it's not typical for a company to do this. Well, it's not entirely true. In fintech, it is getting more typical. But, you know, the common advice you get is like, oh, doing both is tough. And yeah, it is tough. There's no doubt about that. But why do we do it? We did it because over the last 6-7 months, we started getting inbounds from other fintechs who were serving consumers saying, looks like you're doing a lot on credits and open banking data analytics. Can you help us out with our own analytics and lending product launches? And of course, initially, you know, a part of my kind of grand vision and pitch had always been there is a moment where we do open up some of our tech to help power more innovation and better lending products to be created with our knowledge. But I'd expected that to be a bit later. But the demand was strong enough that we did a market research with the board in early 2022, and then did a lot of customer dev. I think we spoke to like 100 different B2B businesses. And then, maybe I'm too cautious, but then we did benchmarking to check how good our open banking analytics was compared to others. And it turns out that it is really, really good. Our kind of core credit models perform better than major incumbents. And we've been able to prove things like open banking data on its own can be a powerful, even more powerful predictor of credit risk than credit file data, which is traditionally what is used. So with that, we decided, okay, let's go all in. So last month, we officially launched Fuse. And what Fuse is a set of APIs that you can use to underwrite your lending products. And so we use open banking data primarily to do cash flow analysis and also bespoke credit risk feature development for businesses to help make smarter decisions. And it does very strongly match up with our mission, because if you can help business become more efficient, that means they can accept more people and offer them credit, and also lower the interest rate they charge them. And so that's something that systemically you need to do. You have to have a consumer side and a business side to do both. And that's why we made the decision to do both.
Yeah, awesome. That's great. And as you said, it's happening, but it's not an easy route to go down. And I'm sure it's been challenging at times, clearly very well thought out and very well executed. Challenges are part and parcel of founder life. You and I both know that. You've been going on this journey now for over 4 years. Tell us a bit about, you know, the hardest parts of this ride so far. And it'd be great to understand, like, compared to the early challenges you faced, like, what's been the major difference between what you're contending with now?
Early stage businesses have this weird thing where some businesses skip this phase, but if you haven't found product market fit, you end up in this place where you're creating products based on hypotheses, and then you'll ship the product, and then there'll be like, you know, crickets, nothing. And you're like, ah, damn. And you got to start again. And I think in those environments, when you're getting limited feedback from the market or customers, it's really important for founders to set their own quite detailed week by week goals. And this is something that I had completely underestimated how difficult that is, because it's really demotivating in the early days to, you know, keep building, but nothing to happen. And you need a bit of tenacity and planning to get through that. So I would say very, very early stage startups, that's the hardest part, keeping the vision, keeping the conviction that you want to do it. And I think a lot of people drop off at that phase because they expect more immediate feedback from the market, but such is usually not the case. And then I would say, I mean, look, we're not that big, but like, you know, when you have multiple management layers type phase, one of the biggest challenges, I think, is hiring a good leadership team. That's a art that I think you have to make mistakes and learn from them before getting it right. And it takes a lot of time, but you do get better at it. And then not just hiring them, but then nurturing the right culture, because a lot of the culture will kind of cascade from the leadership team. And I do think that's true. And so that's another very difficult thing later stage. I would say like delegation at this stage of the business is also difficult because, you know, when you've been the one in the weeds for so long, it's hard to let go of it, even though you should, because your role is not useful anymore doing that. I would say those are the biggest things that stand out to me.
No, great advice. And yeah, I can relate to all of them. We're obviously at an interesting time in the world, heading into more choppy waters, economic downturn. There's political turmoil, depending on your persuasion. There's obviously the war in Ukraine. There's a lot happening in the world. And that is obviously brings opportunity, but it also brings a lot of uncertainty and can be very hard for people and particularly for founders that are trying to build a business, given that the VC funding is less frothy. So I'd love to just get your take on the upcoming kind of the months ahead, any advice that you have for fellow founders. You know, you've been in the seat now for a while, built a very successful business. Have you got any sort of tips and advice for anyone that might be just starting out in this stage? Because I'm sure they really appreciate your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this stage, stepping back, the first thing I think about is the problems that exist in the market don't like cease to exist overnight because of a cyclical downturn. In fact, some problems get accentuated, right? Like helping people manage how much credit they're taking out or whatever. And I think it one sort of mental misconception, but something that can happen is if you look at the headlines and it's doom and gloom, you think, terrible time to start a business. I don't think that's true. Not to say that it's not a tough time to start a business, right? Because if, there isn't as much capital available, you have to be extremely lean. You have to be the best of the best to get funded. And so it puts life on hard mode for sure. So I would say like on the first point, right? I wouldn't be disillusioned because of the market climate about, you know, there not being any ideas you can work on, but you do have to be realistic about the time and effort it might take and how good you're going to have to be to win in that market if you're going down a startup, venture-backed, private sector route. And so I guess like being aware of what you're getting into is an important thing. But I do think tenacity and conviction does actually play a big part in it. So if you believe in what you're doing and you think it's what you want to do, you should definitely do it. Expect that it's going to be tougher.
Very true. And considering what you do at Pave, it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about the wider public. And I think pretty much everybody that will be listening to this podcast may well be looking at their financial health, being a little bit nervous about what's coming. So what advice do you have just in general, broader financial health advice to anyone listening to this that might be a little bit nervous about the current situation?
Yeah, I think you've named the main things where like everything's getting more expensive because of inflation and energy bills and all this. There's also slightly less, I would say, job security. Still maybe a bit too early to see how that's going to pan out across the market, but I think we should expect it to get less secure. And I think in those environments, like at least when I think about what I would say to like our customer demographic, that there are quite small but meaningful things that you can do. I was chatting to an energy company executive who gave me these tips, which I'll relay here, and I'm sure they wouldn't mind. But I think there's some things like, you know, as practical and easy as like turning the temperature up on your refrigerator that can save money, or like unplugging appliances and these kinds of things. The other big one is going for a dual tariff and running all your washing machines overnight and this kind of stuff on a cheaper tariff. These things can actually add up to a lot of savings. So maybe I'm going too micro here, but I think about those when I think about what our customers might be going through. The other thing when it comes to like more specifically credit is, look, I wouldn't be working in credit if I thought it was a outright evil thing, right? And I think credit has an important place to play in the market and in times like these. And like used correctly, you can actually save money over time, I think, by intelligently using offers like from credit cards or buy now, pay later firms, or just proactively trying to navigate the deals and understanding the best way to get access to credit if you need it. And those things do count and add up over time. So I think there's just a lot of detailed things that you can do to save quite a bit of money, which I certainly think about a lot.
No, that's really good advice. And given everything that Pave stands for, beyond the work you do at Pave, I'd love to know your take on what more needs to happen more generally to help make the world a more financially inclusive place. Have you got any particular thoughts or advice for any politicians or companies listening that could help this?
My EWC slightly socialist side might come out. I'm not, by the way, but that's still, it's going to sound like it. The stats are like more than almost a quarter, I think, of people in the UK think that the financial system has locked them out in some way, or they feel insecure about the future when it comes to money. And that's a huge amount of people, right? That's 10 million or more. And I think that feeling isn't just about COVID and recent macroeconomic volatility. It comes from a much, much deeper structural economic change that we're going through since the 1970s in society, which is to do with the split between productivity not catching up with economic growth. So meaning people are earning less and basically relative to like how much things are costing. And so the wealth disparity in our economies has been growing consistently for multiple decades now. So we haven't actually moved the needle when it comes to inequality in developed markets. And that's a structural issue, right? And I think what I think about a lot is I don't think we're doing enough progressive taxation at a system-wide level. And I think that's true of many, many countries. Like, I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done by the public sector to push that agenda through bravely and just do it. I think personally, more as a kind of speaking as a founder, and this is a great sort of opportunity to hopefully reach some audiences that this might resonate with. But I also think as entrepreneurs and as founders, we have a responsibility to be a lot more picky about what problems we decide to solve. And I use this example a lot, and I won't name the company name, but like, you know, having a $1,000 juicer or like, I don't know, juice compressing machine that, you know, eventually goes bust and millions of pounds getting invested into that is such, sorry, but BS, right? Like those are not the problems we need to be solving as a society right now. And it gets me really angry. No offense to anyone, but like, I genuinely think that we have a finite amount of time on this earth, finite resources, and the types of problems that people need to solve have to be much, much, much more socially oriented and not profit seeking as its primary. Of course, that's important, but it can't be the primary cause anymore. We've gone beyond that point as a society. So my kind of call to action here for people is if you're going to be a founder, please think about the problem you're solving and what you're going to dedicate your life to and make it something meaningful.
I absolutely love that. And I think it's very, very possible to combine purpose and profit. And I'm on the advisory board of a fantastic accelerator called Unrest, which is all centered around impact and helping the next generation of founders build great businesses that do good in the world and impact the world for the right thing. And I think there is a growing group of younger entrepreneurs coming through that I think will follow through on that. I really do believe. But we do need to keep talking about it and reminding everybody of like, that there are these big problems and they're exciting problems to tackle, right? And I think that's in itself, hopefully lots of people listening will, if you've got that entrepreneurial spirit, can stoke the fires and hopefully you can get out there and have a big impact in the world, because I totally agree with that. We've obviously talked a lot about Pave, and I think we've got a great glimpse into you as a person, but I'd love to talk about a bit more about you as a founder, because there are lots of entrepreneurial people and just generally leaders listening to this. So how would you describe your leadership style? What's the biggest lessons that you've learned as a founder and a leader, and how's that evolved, you know, over the last few years?
I certainly think about this one a lot. We do a lot of 360 feedback, and I think the themes that come up in the feedback, but also exit interviews are amazing, because you get a lot of insight into people's experiences of your culture and leadership. The one that repeatedly comes up is that we do have quite a open culture. So I'm very happy to be vulnerable with the team if I'm going through a tough time personally, or if I think like it's a really difficult problem that we're solving as a business and that I'm having a tough time like cracking it or whatever. I've always had a very open, as much as possible, policy. Obviously, you don't want to do it too much because that can be ultimately distracting and unproductive, but I definitely err on the side of being open, and I'm proud of that. I think that's a good form of leadership. I think the other thing that I've invested a lot of time in is it's not easy to get people to do this, but strong feedback culture and practicing that by being very open to feedback. I think being open to feedback is actually easier, I think, than giving good feedback, but it's something that we continuously try and practice and develop in the business. The last thing that comes to mind would be I hate getting managed. I hate getting told what to do. I think a lot of the really good talents are similar. And we try to give people super high degrees of autonomy and trust in, you know, give them a task and they will execute it and start as a baseline there and then hold them accountable. And that's how I would describe like the leadership style that we have. and I hope the team would feel the same. I think that sounds great, right? But in practice, it's really difficult because I think the more autonomy you give people, the more accountability you have to set. And those things kind of, they don't contradict, but they're almost in tension a little bit. It's like, yeah, you can do whatever you want. It's not what we say, but like taking a kind of drastic example, you can do whatever you want to do, but then getting pissed off at them when they don't deliver results. Like it has to come with accountability and a set of objectives that you can measure. And I think I personally, as a leader, have sometimes struggled to find that right balance and still do. And it's something I'm continuously working on refining because, yeah, I definitely don't think I would be a good kind of top-down military style leader. It's not my style and I have to be authentic to who I am, but it has to come with accountability, which is critical and important to balance.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And one topic that we've talked a lot about on the podcast, comes up a lot on social media, I think as well, is imposter syndrome, something that I have suffered with and battle with. I think like a lot of founders that start businesses quite young, like we both did. Can you share your own experience of dealing with imposter syndrome and any advice for anyone that is maybe struggling with it right now and we can try and help overcome it?
Yeah. And I think ultimately, like for me, imposter syndrome is just a sense that like we live in a society with as humans, we quickly will try and categorize people into different buckets. And if you don't think you belong in that bucket, you can feel very uncomfortable. And so as you can imagine, like for me, I didn't necessarily come from an entrepreneurial background prior to this. There was no pedigree there, so to speak. And adding to that, being an ex-consultant, there is a lot of unjustified by data stigma attached to coming from one of the MBB firms or whatever. When, as you pointed out, right, it doesn't make any sense because a lot of the best startup founders are ex-McKinsey, ex-Bain, whatever. But I think you just have to like rationalize to yourself that like that sense of not belonging is actually quite an artificial construct in your brain. There is, of course, some more practical things that are true constraints. Like, you know, if you come from a wealthy family, you might have better contacts and might get better funding and all that. But that aside, I think a lot of it is mental and you just have to work through personally to do that. For me, the best way to work through it was to throw myself into the situation and prove to myself that I can do it and build confidence in a sort of ground up way. And that's, you know, maybe not the magic answer people want to hear, but I can only say like now having done this for 5 years, if someone turns around and said, you know, ex-McKinsey people can't be consultants, can't be entrepreneurs. I'm like, well, it's just not true. Like, and I know that because I am, you know, and so that to me is the best, kind of antidote to that.
Thank you very much. I think others will really appreciate that because it's something that can consume people and stop them from achieving their potential or going for things that they should. And that's always a real shame. And I often need to check myself when those thoughts creep in because we wouldn't be where we are if we didn't have potential or talent. And sometimes it's just that you need the right people around you sometimes, I think, to kind of help you see that. And I know, like myself, you have, you know, talked about the benefit you've had from mentorship from fellow founders and other people in the ecosystem. And I think that it is also incredibly important.
I think I should have mentioned that too. I totally agree. I think finding someone whose background resonates with yours, who has done something that you respect, and then it doesn't have to be entrepreneurship. It can be like hardship because, you know, they're one and the same thing. And then making sure you stay in contact with them, that can be extremely powerful, I think.
So true. So it's been a real joy to chat. I've taken a lot from it. I know our listeners will too. We're sadly at the end. We've got four wrap-up questions for you. So we'll start with one that I'm very excited to hear the answer to. In one sentence, what do you think the future holds for Pave?
Yeah, I think the Fuse platform has had some incredible deep tech, but still kind of early stage breakthroughs when it comes to credit analytics. And the more we invest in these, the more confident I am that they're going to really change how lending is done. So I think the future holds, you know, huge promise for us on changing credit analytics from a kind of underwriting perspective. And I know that sounds nerdy, but I'm really, really excited about that because there's some cool stuff we're developing.
Nice. And at the end of your career, what do you want to be remembered for?
Well, for me, what matters most is, first of all, whether or not I like influenced people's lives positively, because that's at the end of the day, that I think that's all it really boils down to. And that doesn't just mean customers, although that's important, of course, but also the people that I work with. If people can look back on the company experience they had and say that was a good place to work, then that makes me extremely happy. Yeah.
Amazing. And if you could be mentored by anyone, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I don't think I have a specific person. I actually try and surround myself with people that are doing things very different to what I do, which is a bit of a, you know, maybe counterintuitive take, but I think it's really important that we understand perspectives of people who are like doing a farming commune, or I don't know, who are musicians, because the hardships that we share as humans are often similar, and the creative problem solving that you need to do is similar. And what matters more is surrounding yourself with people that, I think I mentioned this up front, but true to themselves, because that's when I think you unlock the best in you. And I think those are my mentors, and they're typically friends and family.
Amazing. Love that answer. And last question, Shay, what final piece of advice would you have for our listeners? What do you want to leave them with?
If you have an idea, start it now. Honestly, that's I wish I had the courage to start what I'm doing now earlier. It's tough, but honestly, I think it's just the best way to like self-actualize and genuinely carve out something that matters to you. So I would just urge everyone to get going as soon as possible.
Get going, make it happen. Love that. Cheers, Shay. Really enjoyable conversation. Very excited to see what the future holds for you and Pave. And it's, we're all about supporting people that are doing good in the world and building purpose-driven companies. And you are the epitome of that. So we wish you all the very best with that. And hopefully we'll get you back on at some point to hear about the next stage of the story.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Great speaking with you.
Cheers, Shay. What an inspiration Shay is. He truly is the epitome of combining purpose and profit. And I really wish him and the Pave team all the very best in the years ahead, as they're doing really important work. So if you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did, please don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. I am really excited for you to join us next week when we're going to be joined by the incredible Amali D'Alwis, former CEO of Code First Girls and CEO of Subac, the world's first accelerator for climate non-for-profits. Here are some snippets from the episode. I hope you enjoy them and I look forward to seeing you next week.
It's not about if I don't have it at 100%, I don't go. It's more about if I've got 75%, it's a go. And then this 25% are the bits that I need to work on. And this is how I would go about doing that. So make the move real, I guess, and try to understand what that looks like. We have this incredible growth environment, this incredible growing industry, and yet people aren't being part of that, and women aren't being part of that. Half of the population is not being part of that because of social sort of constructs. And that for me just felt deeply unfair. If there is no planet for us in 100 years, that's a pretty big issue, right? And, you know, whilst the planet will continue on, human beings, you know, we're the ones who will suffer, right? So we have this time crunch. We are trying to solve these problems at speed. We know that these big issues are not just localized, that they are global.
Thanks so much for tuning into today's 40-Minute Mentor episode. And if you're enjoying the podcast series so far, we'd love to see you at our live recording at the Sifted Summit in London on October the 5th and 6th. Our live discussion will be all about purpose over profit and will feature some of the most successful purpose-driven founders and investors in the tech ecosystem. Plus, you'll get the chance to ask your own questions and get involved in the discussion. So if this sounds interesting, please make sure you head over to www.summit.sifted.eu and claim one of our 40 free tickets by redeeming the code 40MM3. That's all one word, 40MM3. You can find all the details in today's show notes and over on the JBM website. I hope I'll see you there.